this is just a change. It's history happening right now, and I don't think it's going to stop.
Where were you when black people were being killed and there was no accountability?
Yes.
They're sticking the military branches on us now, and that's terrifying.
The NYPD is being excessively aggressive with this crowd here, and it is inappropriate. And I'm an elected official, and they just pepper sprayed me.
I saw a tremendous amount of restraint, but I also saw things that need to be done better.
Semi-trailer rolls through a packed highway of protesters in Minneapolis.
Are you okay?
I'm getting shot!
Katie, are you okay?
As I speak right now, we are actively being looted.
Over 170 businesses were damaged last night.
We had a number of police officials and officers that were being attacked.
They have that as a picture, right, that we looted. That's going to be the main story. And that's not the main story right here.
Now, at this point, they're not caring what color we are. We're in every city across this country. They're shooting at everybody.
My administration will stop mob violence, and we'll stop it cold.
People are sick and tired of what's going on, and change needs to happen. Hopefully, some change actually do happen.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Over the weekend, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets in cities across the United States in response to the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And in many areas, law enforcement responded with force, firing at demonstrators and members of the press with tear gas and rubber bullets. While George Floyd's killing is galvanizing this uprising, his death is only the latest in a series of events that make this such a painful moment for black people in the United States. At the same time that people of color are disproportionately dying of COVID-19, and as the crisis has left millions unemployed, violence against black people remains. The uprising we're seeing is also fueled by anger over the death of 26-year-old Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky, who was shot and killed by police officers in her home in March, and the killing of 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery by two white men in Georgia this February. Joining me now from Minneapolis is Aaron Morrison, national race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press. Aaron, thanks for coming back on the show.
It's good to be with you.
So you've been in Minneapolis covering the uprising that we're seeing there. What's the response to the demonstrations that we've been seeing from law enforcement over the weekend?
Well, the response from law enforcement really has gone from one of trying to quell small demonstrations to really, as the world learned about the death of George Floyd, those protests, those demonstrations, and the unrest growing so significantly that it seemed at times the law enforcement here was really overwhelmed and unable to stop all of it.
Aaron, you're there. You're seeing this with your own eyes. I think a lot of what happens when we being media consumers, end up seeing these images, things kind of get distorted. Is the media reporting on this accurately in terms of what you're seeing? Because there are lots of different ideas about who is on the ground during these active moments. And are they from in-state? Are they from out-of-state? Are they multiracial? Like, is what you're seeing on the ground connecting to what's being reported?
To some extent, yes. I mean, the demonstrations here are quite large. And the level of devastation here, I would say it's pretty significant. The first night I arrived, I went out to just see what was going on. And there were fires burning. There was looting going on. But I want to be careful, to your point, I want to be careful not to make it seem like the entire city of Minneapolis or the entire Twin Cities region is on fire. That is not the case. There are areas of this city that look like nothing is going on in this in this area, and that, you know, that this isn't the epicenter, so to speak, of the George Floyd protests. However, I think the more important point here is that there were times during early on in last week where people were really wondering if, you know, they could have any sort of trust in any part of their system of government here. I mean, fire departments weren't showing up to put fires out, and we asked the fire departments why they weren't out, you know, coming to extinguish fires, and the response we got was that the fire departments felt like they weren't safe to come out and put the fires out themselves.
One of the things that we hear also is that protesters across the country so far, I mean, there were protests here in New York, that the protesters are essentially asking for to go beyond. They're questioning the charges that were brought against the officer who killed George Floyd, in particular third degree murder. But they're also asking for the other officers who were involved to also be arrested and charged. There are some protesters who are bringing up other Black Americans who have died at the hands of police, Breonna Taylor, for example. And again, bringing this back to a couple of years ago with Ferguson, that was really the rise of Black Lives Matter. And a lot of the protests were sort of at least loosely organized around that theme, that organization, if you will. Are you noticing these protesters are unified in terms of their messaging? Are they asking for the same types of charges against the other officers? Are they asking for, you know, to bring attention to Breonna Taylor? Are they organized through Black Lives Matter? Or is this sort of more of an organic uprising?
I would say the uprising is organic, but there is certainly a Black Lives Matter presence here. I've spoken to a few of the organizers, and they are supporting the community as best they can, you know, in the middle of you know, not only a pandemic, but in the middle of, you know, a pretty fluid situation. You know, law enforcement has really gone from almost a hands-off approach from what I saw when I first got here to now an overwhelming show of force, tear gas, flashbang grenades, and rubber bullets. And, you know, I was out at a one protest on Saturday evening, and an entirely peaceful protest happening in an intersection near the 5th police precinct. They were sitting down in the middle of an intersection, and the state police, supported by the National Guard, started firing on them.
I want to bring in another guest to the conversation now, Mark Lamont Hill, who's a professor of media studies at Temple University. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So a lot of what Aaron is talking about is not unique. We have continued to see, and again, watching this unfold, almost felt reminiscent of, you know, there are people who were comparing this to 1968. I would go, you know, as near as, again, the protests and the uprising in Ferguson after Michael Brown was killed. These images are showing me, Mark, is that, again, there's a use of a militarized police force. Aaron just mentioned the flashbangs and the rubber bullets. All of that was present in Ferguson. Tell me what you see as the effect that that's having on the protests right now. Because in Ferguson, it took about 2 weeks before the National Guard was deployed. We're looking at less than a week as cities around the country are deploying their National Guard and those and other local police forces that are coming in with some pretty heavy artillery.
I think it's stunning to see. And, you know, even speaking to some protesters on the ground and also surveying the media landscape, particularly social media, what we're hearing is that it only compounds the frustration that people already felt. There's a sense that for the last few months in the midst of COVID, there was very little intervention, very little support. And the moment people express their frustration against state violence, suddenly there's all kinds of federal intervention, but not the kind they were looking for. The response immediately looks like there's no room for protest, that there's no room to express legitimate outrage, that the state is more interested in protecting property and protecting white fear than it is making sure that Black lives are safe or that justice prevails in this instance. At least that's what many people on the ground are saying. You know, there was a sense in Ferguson particularly because so many people were coming out of town and because so much was happening. And as you said, for so long it was happening, that they, not that they understood why military, why the National Guard came in, but they, there was at least a logic to it that the state can't even appeal to now. You know, when moments after, it's, it felt like moments after they hit the ground, the protesters hit the ground, there was suddenly such a strong, powerful pushback from the state. And when you add Donald Trump's tweets to it, it certainly gives corroboration to that belief.
I want to get into the president's tweets in a minute, though. I do feel like they do get a ton of attention and sometimes overtake the conversation here. So before we do that, I want to mention President Trump, as well as Minnesota's Democratic Governor Tim Walz, said something that I think is interesting, and I'm hearing this sort of in different areas, that once protests turn quote-unquote violent, once you begin, you know, with fires and other things, that they no longer are about George Floyd's death, that that sort of dilutes and removes the focus from George Floyd and really turns it to something else. I'm wondering what your response is to those statements.
Well, first of all, it's never been purely about George Floyd. George Floyd was a tragic occurrence that happens after a string of tragic occurrences. If black people rebelled every time there was injustice, every time there was a bad shoot, every time there was a state involved or a police involved killing, we would do nothing but rebel. There'd be nothing but quote unquote riots around the country. This was about a system and a structure. And George Floyd is just the latest and most tragic example of that. And no, I don't believe that we lose our moral authority or our political strength when we see acts of disruption that don't look the way people want them to. I think that we have to be honest and say that oftentimes the state only responds. The national mainstream public only pays attention when they see buildings torn down, when they see demonstrations that go beyond the hashtag or beyond running a marathon for someone. So I think that it's wrongheaded to somehow say that unless you do a peaceful march or a peaceful sit-in, that somehow you don't have the moral authority to complain or that somehow you've muted George Floyd's voice or you somehow obscured the problem. Because again, the problem isn't a singular bad instance. The problem is a system and a structure that is designed to yield outcomes that are unequal. And when protesters take a moment to put a cog in the, or rather to jam up the machine, to pause the machinery of capitalism, to pause the sense of normalcy that often accompanies Black death, and to say, hey, wait a minute, everybody, pay attention to us. We're dying here, we're hurting here, and there's no end in sight. When we do that, even if it means doing some things that people don't like, I think it actually enhances the message. Again, that's not to say that every single act that's ever happened on the street is right. That's not to say that I agree with every tactical choice people have made. But to act like these acts of disruption are besides the point, I think is to miss the point.
Aaron, I want to bring you in just for one second here, because I think, you know, a lot of what I'm seeing, and we have to remember, of course, that this is not happening in isolation. We are having this uprising is happening in the middle, really, of a global pandemic. We do not have a vaccine for the coronavirus or COVID-19. And you see protesters who are masked and who are still out at these actions. Is there any concern when you speak to protesters? Are they concerned about that in this moment when you talk to them on the ground?
Some of them are expressing concern about the idea that in the middle of a public health emergency, one that we haven't really seen in a century, that they are putting themselves at undue risk or unnecessary risk by being out and being so close together as they are. But, you know, the one thing that struck me, one activist yesterday said that all they've been asking for were the arrest of the three additional officers. But instead of arresting those officers, they sent the military. And so that's really why the protests continue. It's because they feel like you guys are not really hearing us. Or if you're hearing us, you're not really listening. And that's what they've been telling me. So I think to some degree, the pandemic is on everyone's mind here. Yes, people are wearing masks, but they also see this moment and this cause as just as important as being able to, you know, protect their lives. And let's not forget, too, this is, you know, we're talking about protests that have come after two, almost 3 months of an economic shutdown. There are people who are still not sure if they're going to be able to pay their rent right now. There are still people who don't have jobs. And on top of that, if you're in a city where people are, you know, looting and destroying businesses, you may not have a job to even return to when things open again.
And just to add to that, I mean, the fact that Black Americans have been disproportionately affected by coronavirus and COVID-19 in terms of the death rate. This is a community that is being hit from multiple angles, economic, public health, and some would argue that this is a public health issue. What happened to the effects of policing on the Black community? Mark, I want to touch back a little bit on the tone of what we're hearing from elected officials. We've heard from everyone from Governor Cuomo here in New York. They're not pleased with the way that the uprisings and the protests have turned to, you know, buildings on fire, etc. There's a tone, however, that I'm wondering if you can help me understand. It feels as though they're very upset with the protesters. But when I think back to Charlottesville, for example, I don't, and maybe I'm wrong here, but I feel like elected officials just don't have the similar tone when it comes to dealing with white agitators and white protesters that they do when the issue is affecting Black people, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes complete sense. White outrage is legitimate. And what we see in Charlottesville, you know, with the statue, or what we see in the Michigan State House over this very flawed, I would argue, notion of liberty with regard to opening back up the country or opening back up the state so that people can, you know, access haircuts and manicures and tattoos and such. The response to that was one of acceptance. It was one that said that these are Americans and the First Amendment allows them to do it, and civil disobedience is a virtue. And they were essentially applauded. I mean, from the president on down. He specifically used the language of liberty to describe who and what they are. Juxtapose that to what we're seeing right now on the ground around the country. Honestly, you see a language of intolerance, a language of control and containment and blame. That seems fairly consistent when we look again at what was happening in Central Florida after the Trayvon Martin death killing. What we saw in Ferguson after the killing of Michael Brown, what we saw in New York after Eric Garner, we could go on down the list, Sandra Bland in Texas. There's a sense that when Black folk push back, they need to be contained and surveilled, even before it gets to the point of violence, because some would say, oh, well, you know, those white folk weren't violent. I can assure you that if Black people went to any state house with AR-15s and yelled in the faces of cops, and protested without ever causing any physical harm to anyone, the response from the state would not be the same. And we see it over and over and over again. History bears this out. So I think, again, there's a sense that white people have a greater investment in America and a heightened sense of citizenship. And so when they exercise First Amendment rights, it's seen as normal. When Black folk do it, it's like, what are you doing here?
We saw two prominent journalists, Katie Couric and Don Lemon, both tweeted interesting things. Don Lemon talked about how the president, President Trump, has yet to sort of be a calming presence. And, you know, sort of where is the president in this moment with a message of calm? And I'm paraphrasing here. Katie Couric, on the other hand, tweeted that it would be good for President Barack Obama and President George Bush to make a joint appearance to sort of, you know, give a calming message to the country. Mark, whose job is it at this point? I mean, President Trump is the current president of the United States. Is it Barack Obama's responsibility or former presidents to come in, step up to the plate and try to calm tensions right now?
There's a long history of wanting Black folk to come clean up white folks' messes in America. So the expectation that Barack Obama will come and calm everybody down is an interesting one. I'm not sure if George W. Bush does that for many Americans, but if they come out jointly, what it does is it's a way of almost grandstanding or showing up a sitting president, at least in the minds of the presidential fraternity. Obviously, Donald Trump has disrupted that logic in many ways, but in general, presidents don't try to step on the toes or in the spotlight of others. So I don't expect that to happen. The question of whose job it is Donald Trump's job. There's no doubt about that. But I would love to see calming voices emerge from around the country, not just former presidents, but anyone with a voice, anyone with a public facing platform should be trying to speak calm, try to advocate for justice. Because as always, justice is the precondition for peace. It's not enough to call for peace. We must also call for justice.
Mark Lamont Hill is a professor of media studies at Temple University. And Aaron Morrison is a national race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.